the living room being served, when actually a significant portion of humans are in the kitchen cooking our food and bringing us service, and then an even more substantial amount of humans are actually cleaning the gutter and the you know,
and the toilets.
And the toilets.
Another thing that could be very helpful for listeners is, could you explain, Vanessa, the difference between colonization, colonialism, and coloniality and its relation to modernity?
So, again, in terms of heteroglossia, colonialism and colonization, because I think there's colonization, colonialism, and coloniality, that we have to be creating distinctions in order to be able to put on the table and to visibilize the problem, right? So colonization as a process of occupation of lands and subjugation of peoples that is political and visible, like in policies. We might say that for some countries has ended, but I live in a settler colonial state where it never ended. It's still here. And again, if you look at it from the perspective of indigenous people, it's for them, it's not so much the political process that is being criticized right now. It is the driver of this process, which is the turning of the land into property, right? And the principle of accumulation and individualism. So all of these things go with that concept. If we go into colonialism, maybe we bring these principles into colonialism. And we can say that if we use it metaphorically, which is problematic, but we are going to do it, our unconscious is colonized. Our imagination is colonized because we can only imagine one single story. We have been conditioned to imagine a single story of progress, development, and civilization. And we can't see the harm and the violence and the unsustainability of the single story for our relationships and for the planet at large. Now, coloniality is a term that is super useful that came out of scholars in Latin America, especially Aníbal Quijano, who said that, like, generally when we think about colonization ending with the political processes being interrupted at that layer, we do not realize that the hierarchies and the sense of superiority of those who have colonized, this is not something that goes away. And that sense of superiority still designs what happens in terms of social organization and relationships within society. So the effects of that political process and also the meta-ontological or metaphysical grounding of that, they remain. The epistemicide that it creates continues, right? It continues to denigrate and subalternize other ideals, other forms of knowledge, other ways of thinking about the self, about reality, about the future, about the past, the present, and the future. It's very difficult to say this is what it means, and this is what colonialism means, this is what colonization meant, and this is what coloniality means, because our current generation of heteroglossic young people are questioning everything at a rate and at a speed and at a depth that we have not probably seen before. And this is aided by their dominion of technology, right? And lives lived in the virtual world, and which then has its own problems in terms of the creation of echo chambers and bubbles and our inability then, at the same time, a hyper ability to navigate multiple perspectives, but an inability to relate sometimes to other, and also why we communicate, right? So before the internet, maybe communication had a very different purpose. Today, it's very much attached to the addictions we are talking about. So we want to be validated. We want to feel the sense of authority. We want to feel the sense that we are the arbiters of reality. We want to be affirmed. We want to feel that we have a kind of a throne, and that will be respected in that throne. And maybe this is only possible within echo chambers, right? And part of facing the decline of modernity is understanding this is unsustainable. So what I generally say when I'm talking about these struggles, right, for what we could call it identity struggles or diversity struggles. So we can use the metaphor that there was a palace. Modernity can also be seen as a palace with the occupiers of the throne, of the marble thrones, being the usual suspects. Mm-hmm. But then there is a period where other people who inhabit differently situated and non-normative bodies were offered the opportunity to also occupy the stage for a bit. So they were offered plastic thrones. They are there fighting for these plastic thrones in the palace that is falling apart. So when is it that we're going to realize that the whole system, there are cracks in the wall, there is a storm coming, and we will need an evacuation plan where we are trying to avoid a stampede also that will create a lot of harm if people panic, right? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, people are already panicking, and we can see aggression and violence escalating and the social fragmentation. So we're dealing with a situation that is unlike any other situation in the past, because we have different generations with different kinds of relationship to technology and to modernity itself. And we see the conflict between generations, within generations, and in relation to the planet itself. And we don't know what to do. My attempt to do something responsible in this scenario is to try to envisage an education that gives us a compass towards sobriety, maturity, discernment, and accountability that helps us layer ourselves and layer reality itself so that we can hold space for the complexities that we see at this point in time. And with that, my hope is that we will be able, once we reach that rock bottom, we will be able to hold each other's hands in order to be able to move together into a different form of reality, where we would have learned from facing all these wrongs and used our many types of rationality available to us, the many different knowledges in an ecology of knowledges to guide us towards. Here, I'm not talking only about Western humanism or Enlightenment humanism. I think this would be one of the knowledges available, but in a more mature form, after having been through all of this, right? And other knowledges together that do not see knowledge just as worded narratives, but that also understand that knowing is in the body and it is in our relationships with other beings. I think that together these knowledges and ways of knowing and ways of being could take us into a very different reality and into a very different space. I think for us to be able to do that, to even start this process, I've called it a tightrope where we walk. It's a tightrope between desperate hope, like where we are trying to hold on to a single answer or a group that has the answers, or a nostalgic past where we had the answers, right? So we have to let go of that. And on the other side of the tightrope, there is the fear of hopelessness and despair, where there's misanthropy, there's banalization of cruelty, there's all of that. And we have people already inhabiting these spaces. Now, the tightrope is about not falling for either, not falling for desperate hope or desperate hopelessness, but learning to walk with honesty, which means seeing the realness of the situation and not turning away, learning to walk with humility, with humor, and with hyper self-reflexivity. And this means learning to hold space for the pain of all of this, in all the mistakes and all the wrongs, and not trying to be rescued from the discomfort that this is going to create.
Yeah, of course. And this all brings me back very much to the metaphor, to the prism of addiction and recovery, because one of the ways of describing what I suffer from is a chronic inability to deal with discomfort. That's what my addiction is. And it's also, you talk about sobriety, which of course is relevant. And in a way also, it's also very much about maturity. Recovery is just, you know, doing on a regular basis what you don't want to do. That's one definition of good recovery, which seems, you know, relevant here. I remember the first time that I encountered your work, I was really struck by the fact that you were taking the conversation somewhere else than where it usually ends up, the conversation about the unsustainability of our current model, our current system. Because traditionally the conversation is between people who, or the public conversation is between the people who argue that, no, the thing, you know, this ship is fundamentally working, you know, we might need to repair it here or there. And then the people who say, no, the ship is sinking. That's the conversation. And what I found really interesting immediately when I heard you speak was about the fact that, in a way, what I find more scary is not the insanity of the Trump era and what came from and continues to come from that side of the political spectrum, because this is pathological. There's something that comes from a place of such fear and anger, and which is fear, packaged in a different way. There's something clear about that. It's ugly, but it's not difficult to label. What is much more scary, actually, is the progressive answer to that, in a way. I remember you were describing how you had organized a workshop, I think it was in Peru, and you were walking people through like these different situations of collapse and using that term, when I think several people in the workshop said, you know, you collapse as in the water stops running, the road falls apart, there's no more electricity, you can't access a bank teller. And the people responded by saying that that's not collapse. This is reality. This is our life. Like, this is our daily life. And I was really struck recently by a conversation I had with a man who's been a political activist for many, many years. I recalled this example of yours. This is a very committed, very sincere left-wing dude, you know, who's been fighting all his life for feminism, with a real genuine radicality about his approach. And when I told him the way we describe collapse in the West as this thing that might happen one day, perhaps, as if the question was if and when, rather than where, right now. And he said, well, you're talking about a different thing, because you're talking about people left behind in poverty. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about people who are used to a certain life and that life falling apart. And it struck me that even this guy, who's really sort of on the good side in a way, you know, of my, you know, little universe, that's where the problem starts. It's with the good guys, so to speak.
In many ways, I think it's probably one step deeper than that in terms of how our subjectivities are formed within modernity. There are the negations, and he's definitely showing the negation of the connection between our comforts and where they come from, or at whose expense they come from, and the fact that this community probably had their way of life also interrupted by expropriation, destitution, dispossession, and forms of colonialism, right, before. And the fact that we are here protected from this type of collapse that they do not call collapse in this different communities. But I think most importantly is to see that there is a sense within modernity where the economy of self-validation is either plus one or minus one. So if you're not plus one, you're definitely minus one. If you're in order for you not to feel like minus one, you have to be plus one. This is the basics, I think, of why it's very difficult to, if people have built their identity as a good person, as a virtuous person, fighting for either the greatness of America or feminism, it's not going to be an easy task for us to help them confront the complexities and paradoxes and contradictions of that without them feeling minus one. It feels like we're robbing people of the worth that they sense or they have been receiving, the external validation that they're receiving from society for themselves, right? What the communities we work with have been saying for a long time is that we need, first and foremost, we need to get to zero. We need to stop this sense of worthlessness and these economies of worth in order to be able to sit with reality and what this economy has created. Right? And that is about our sense of entanglement and connection with everything else. And in that sense, this plus one, minus one dynamic is also very much connected with our fear of pain, our fear of death, our fear of humiliation. And this is what keeps the economy going. But what if we had a different form of existence where, number one, we're not afraid of pain or of death or of humiliation, and we can actually sit with each other with what's beautiful, what's ugly, what's broken, what's really messed up or fucked up in everything. And in what if we could see the whole spectrum of humanity and beyond within each of us, and not try to monumentalize our lives? So what if we could see ourselves as part of a much larger continuum and act from that space of humility and not see the end of our lives as the end of the bodies we inhabit today? So it was based on these questions, I think, that I recognize that, number one, there is the problem of dealing with negation rather than ignorance, which is very different from, as a teacher, from a pedagogical standpoint. If the problem is ignorance, you present information, that's fine. If the problem is negation, every time you present something that negates what the person wants to hear, you get aggression back. Right. So what you need to design then as a pedagogical process is something that bypasses the defenses of the ego. And you need the person to be with you in this process, right? Because you are going to have to get close, in close proximity to effective landmines that can explode in your face. But the whole, if the whole idea is to deactivate these landmines and create the stamina for all this saturated emotion, saturated shit, both collective and individual, both historical, systemic and related to individual trauma. If we want to move this, if we want to compost this together, first we need to have even the means to face it, right? Mm-hmm. There's, if we don't want to turn towards it, that's a no-go. We are going to drown in that shit collectively. That's what's taking us to possible extinction, right? So the first step, if that's where we're at, in the space of avoiding and not having the stamina, a space of addiction to pleasurable things, in a state of consuming based on the compulsion, right? That's the definition of addiction, is acting out of compulsion. And if we are in a space where we are self-infantilizing and say, oh, no, I just need a safety blanket, just protect me, right? We won't be able to do that. We need to at least convince ourselves that we have become toddlers in a playground, right? And we're having lollipops, and these lollipops are made of shit. And we sometimes the lollipops drop and we want another lollipop, and we want another lollipop of shit. But there's the storm coming that's going to destroy the playground. And unless we say, time's up, time to grow up, time to step up, time to show up differently to one another, to the planet itself, right? Unless we can have this wake-up call that probably comes with a rock bottom. We will have to feel the first effects of the storm. Otherwise, we're going to just continue to go around the merry-go-round or the swing or the slide, and we will find it extremely pleasurable. Mm-hmm. And we will want more of that, right? So I think in many ways, the Earth itself is saying, time's up. We need you out of this playground, and we need you to realize you're part of this, and what you're doing to the extinction of other animals and the collapse for other communities, you're doing to yourselves. You're not doing to others out there, because you're not separated. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one metabolism, and if this metabolism is sick, everybody is sick, and nobody is off the hook here. So it's not going to be a community. Indigenous people do not have the answers. They have practices that help us to be reminded that it is possible to live a different form of existence. But if you want to go there to consume, to extract whatever it is that you're projecting on them, this is not going to work. And that's generally how people understand when we start talking about indigenous knowledges. That's how the consumption kicks in again, right? We then want them to be our hope. This is another self-infantilizing way of addressing the problem. So I think in the projects that I coordinate and the collectives that I'm part of, we know that the issue is not going there and consuming them, but being inspired by the direction of their teachings, which are directions related to maturity, to eldership. So from the beginning, as a child is born, the idea is that this child, the purpose of that life, if you want to put it that way, is for that child to become a good elder and a good ancestor for all relations. So it goes beyond that lifespan. Once you become an ancestor, and ancestors are not those who have come before, are those also yet to come. So it's a spiral. Or circular process, right? But you never see that child as just an individual. It's part of a much bigger thing, and it has responsibilities and obligations that are beyond even one's lifetime. So unless we figure out how to remember some of these teachings, renew some of these teachings, learn from the mistakes we've made with this house, and realize that we are entangled in a wider metabolism that is the planet itself, I don't think we have a chance of getting out of the mess that we have created for ourselves. It's going to be the destruction of the playground with the toddlers in it. Right? And everything else around it too, because these are toddlers with machine guns that are not going to go down peacefully. It will be a disaster, basically. But maybe there's another way.
I've read your book now 3 times, or not exactly the same versions, but and it's landing very differently every time. It's very interesting as a person in recovery for me to see how this happens in a way that is very similar to the way I will read certain teachings that are part of my journey in recovery. Going back to the same thing and repeating things, sometimes without really knowing what's going on, is a really important part of all this. You know, as I mentioned to you, one of our sayings is, you can't think yourself into healthy behavior. You have to act yourself into healthy thinking. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of a mechanical thing that you just have to keep on doing way before you understand the good that it's doing to you.
I have to say, I also find the same thing. I've had to review or revise the text several times. And many times I'm reading it and saying, I need to do this. No. So one of my fears in relation to the book is people interpreting me, and generally it's a way of consuming again, right? Interpreting me as some kind of person who actually is beyond the things that are in the book, or a guru or something. And I definitely don't want to be in that position. I'm frightened, actually, of that mm-hmm. prospect. And when I read my own book, I can see every time that some of the things are landing very differently. And I can see how it can be scary, even for myself.
Of course.
It's not something. I think within modernity, too, we have this hero narratives, right? Or the geniuses narratives. Or this is really nothing to do with that. This is acknowledging that we are all in recovery. We are all affected and conditioned by assholism in our unconscious. And this is going to take a lot of work. It's hard work, and it takes a lot of hard work to interrupt. And by no means I have done all the work that is necessary. I'm learning and mm-hmm. making mistakes and failing. Generatively, I've learned mm-hmm. that I can fail generatively and use the failures as good data and mm-hmm. start then not from scratch, but from experience in my next cycle of learning and unlearning, right? But yeah. The book is written from somebody who's trying to do the work rather than somebody who has done the work already.
Failing better.
Yeah.
Is what we can hope for. Another thing that the book made me think is I thought of how to describe this to friends beyond saying, you know, I use the term ontological dynamite. But another way of referring to it is at first I said this is a book that will allow us to live in a more healthy way, that has the potential to allow us to live in a more healthy way. And then I realized something else, which reminded me of a stage in my journey. And that is that it's also a book that can help us die in a more healthy way. Mm-hmm. You know, at first, that sentence, I know, is going to land. It sounds pretty dreadful. And in a good way, it is. It's full of dread. You know, I remember there was a stage when I started acknowledging fully the violence and unmanageability and unsustainability of our metastasizing superorganism that we call the global economy, mm-hmm. where, you know, we purport to be a rational civilization, but when reason tells us you're committing suicide, we go, no, not at all. And so, you know, we know that there's a really good case to be made that there has never been on planet Earth a moment of real green growth, human built. There's been growth here that has led to disaster there, but that's not green. And when I started grappling with that, at first I went through this phase of despair. And then I realized that there was something about recovery that could help me deal with this information. And that was that I could begin to find solace in the simple fact of not behaving like a jackass. Like that basically just trying sincerely and honestly to do the next right thing as often as possible. And God knows I fail every day, but trying honestly to go back to that place where I'm honestly, genuinely, sincerely trying mm-hmm. was an end in itself.